proceed with the next case of the morning, which is Richard Barthelemy versus Joanne Barnhart. Mr. German?
May it please the court.
I represent Mr. Barthelemy on a Social Security disability claim. Represented him a couple times, actually. We tried it, lost it, appealed it, got it reversed, tried it again, lost it again. That's why I'm here. Two issues. First is the manifest weight argument. That's always a rough one for an appellant. Although I do have some assistance because of the statutes, which state that an administrative law judge can't credit a non-examining physician over a treating physician, and that the opinion of the treating physician must be accepted if well-reasoned and not inconsistent with the other medical records in the file. And that is our position in a nutshell. Dr. Shuresh, who had been his treating physician for a number of years, wrote a very detailed letter set out in the brief stating exactly why the claimant could not work, had multiple difficulties. He was overweight. I can sympathize with that. He had high blood pressure. He had sleep apnea and some heart problems. The overriding problem was his high blood pressure, and that really was probably what kept him from working. He worked in a convenience store, and he'd get such high blood pressure, he'd just have to leave, go home, lay down, and couldn't do the work. And that's supported by the written opinion of Dr. Shuresh. The issue seems to become, how many times was his blood pressure high, or how many times did his blood pressure have a diastolic, 100 or more? This has been an issue. The judge said two. I went through the record. I counted 32. In fact, I made a very thick appendix to my brief.
But over what period of time? I thought if you looked at another period of time, it was six, and so we had a difference between, I think two is obviously wrong, but six might be.
I think if you go from 1996, Your Honor, to 2001, there are 32 separate dates in the appendix.
Well, from the 98 onset date to July 2001, I think that's where we get the number six from.
Well, I'm not sure where they got the number six from, Your Honor. That's why I set out all of them in the appendix, and I had my staff highlight them in yellow so there can be absolutely no question about what's there. And I think it's important. The pre-1998 dates are important because he tried to work back then. And he was having a lot of problems working. If you go back in the record, that's one of the reasons he eventually quit.
Well, they used the date August 20th, 1998. Is that the dividing line of when this period begins? You're obviously counting instances beyond whatever their date is, so maybe the date's wrong.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the reason I'm counting that is Dr. Shuresh's opinion is based upon the totality of medical records he has of the claimant, the totality of the medical records after he quit working, and his medical records before he treated him while he was still working, trying to get this blood pressure under control. When you have to determine whether or not a treating source is credible, I think you have to look at what the treating source looked at. And the treating source looked at 32 documented. I'm not talking about what he takes at home and might have told him. Documented.
Let's just suppose hypothetically, though, we had a lot of instances between 96 and 98, 26 of them, but between 98 and 2001, only six more, perhaps because medication was getting adjusted better, perhaps stress levels are down, perhaps whatever. I mean, there could be reasons why you might have had more events in the pre-onset period than in the post-onset period.
Well, he was working then, and that's dealt with directly in the...
So why can't the ALJ take into account that kind of trend?
Well, the doctor who treated him, Dr. Shuresh, in his detailed opinion, explains in detail how the work pressures themselves create a greater frequency of the diastolics going up. That's exactly what he says in his reasoned opinion.
So you have sort of before and after thing.
Pardon me?
Before this particular date when he was working, he had 32 or we'll say 26 instances of of the high, what is it called, diastolic blood pressure.
Right.
And afterwards, there were only six. That's when he wasn't working, which shows that he can't work. Right? Is that your case?
What I'm saying is that it is consistent with the judge's, with the doctor's opinion. The doctor stated that the pressures of work were on a greater frequency of the uncontrolled blood pressure.
So when he's not working,
he has it less frequently. I guess it's the stress or pressure, he thought, that of the job itself. His job wasn't particularly exertional. And that's another issue, too, since there's a lot of testimony about light capabilities and can you do light work. This is a non-exertional impairment in the main with high blood pressure.
Well, he was running, one of those gas stations that sell food and stuff?
It's convenience. He basically stood behind the counter, you know, made change, sold cigarettes, managed the thing. He had managerial responsibilities, not particularly, you know, exertional.
You got to keep an eye on everything.
But anyway, what I'm saying is I think that there's ample evidence to support the treating source opinion. The doctor that this judge brings in is a general practitioner, never examined the claimant. She was obviously confused at the hearing. However, her answers are not even responsive to the questions that were being asked. There's a reference made to written reports from a Dr. O and a Dr. The name escapes me at the moment. They were written opinions from examining physicians from the Social Security Administration employees who looked at the dry record. And the Whitakus, I believe was his name. But their opinions were in 1998 and 1999. Which were 2 or 3 years before most of the medicals in this file were even developed after that. So to what extent that they would be binding would be minimal at all. So I think you're only left with a non-examining physician who had never examined the claimant at all and who gave non-responsive answers at the hearing. And the second issue that arose that I haven't touched on is what I thought was inappropriate conduct by the administrative law judge at the hearing to poison the whole hearing. I don't think my client got a fair hearing. I think this judge is mad because I reversed him, and he was going to make sure he wasn't going to reverse the second time. He goes to great pains to tell the doctor when he comes in what the evidence showed and what he thought it showed.
What's the evidence of that, that he was mad?
Pardon me?
I know there was an appeals council remand back to the same ALJ, but that's a fairly routine matter, and we do it in outside the Social Security context. Claim that the ALJ was mad at you, that's why?
I think he's mad because he got reversed. I think he took it personally, and he was going to make sure it didn't happen.
What's the evidence of that?
Well, number one, he starts out, if you look at the speech he gives at the beginning of the hearing to the medical expert. She comes in a hearing, and he tells her what he thought the act evidence was in the first hearing.
Why isn't he just bringing her up to speak? You know, she's the expert. I mean, in the court, certainly, under decisions like Leike, the standard is extremely high to show that there's some intra-proceeding bias on the part of the judge, and I don't see any reason why it should be lower for ALJs.
I can give you one.
Federal district judges.
I can give you one. We have no choice to get rid of him. The only way I can get rid of an ALJ if I think he's biased or is not good to my clients is to dismiss the claim and refile, hope I don't get him the next time, or I can move out of his jurisdiction physically.
Well,
I mean, I don't have any right to remove him. I have no right to remove him.
No right to remove without a very substantial showing a federal district court judge either, unless they've got stock in the company or some such thing. But that's precisely my point. When the only thing the judge has done is reviewed the evidence from the prior proceeding, that we're supposed to draw an inference that this particular judge has a thin skin and doesn't like being reversed, it's a big leap. Judges get reversed all the time. We get reversed sometimes. So you have to live with it.
I appreciate that. I can appreciate that. But I think in this case, when you look at the comments of the judge, he tells this young lady that comes in, this doctor, right off the bat, that a previous doctor in a previous hearing said that determined that this lady could, that this man could do light work. There wasn't the doctor he was referring to was a vocational expert. I think he was intentionally trying to mislead this doctor. He tells this doctor, in the prior hearing, I made the determination that she could do light work. I think he's trying to intimidate this doctor. After he tells her that I've decided this guy could do light work, and after this other doctor has decided that she can do light work, he asks her, what do you think he can do? And you know, she says, well, I think he can do light work. I think he steps across the boundary here. I don't think that this is a fair way to conduct a hearing. I don't think my guy got a fair hearing. I think he was robbed of due process. And if this thing's remanded, I'd like to see it go in front of somebody else, which probably isn't going to make any difference because he's been transferred out of this area. He's now in Detroit, so that's probably a moot point anyway. But the point is, I think his conduct of the hearing deprived my client of due process, and that's one of the reasons I'm here. And I maybe we shouldn't be so vitriolic about it, but sometimes I get that way.
Okay.
I'll have it.
Yeah, fine. Thank you. Ms. Hammond?
Good morning. I'm Melinda Hammond for Commissioner Barnhart. Appellant's argument to this court is premised on his claim that his hypertension is in itself disabling. He asserts that his diastolic pressure rose above 100, the level at which the medical evidence in this case indicates symptoms might arise, many times, and that the ALJ refused to acknowledge the medical evidence to this effect. Looking at the complete record from 1998, and the particular date is April 98, that's when plaintiff alleged his disability began, he knew it was no longer able to work, until the date of the ALJ's decision in September 2001. The record shows that Mr. Bartholomew's blood pressure increased when he tried to return to his job, and his job was managing a large mobile mart with 13 employees, a job at which he worked 7 days a week, and which required medium-level exertion, which is lifting up to 50 pounds on an occasional basis, 20 on a frequent basis, standing, walking. He testified that he was required to bend down to fix gas pumps. He testified to significant physically exertional duties. In addition to his managerial duties with many employees, and that we had two vocational experts who confirmed that that sort of job required that degree of exertion.
But here are my two questions for you. One of them is the ALJ is certainly wrong about the number of times after the onset date that his diastolic blood pressure met or exceeded 100. And part of the task is to figure out what's the impact of that mistake on this proceeding. Would the ALJ have seen it the same way? And the second thing is this interaction that Judge Mannion was talking about with stress, because he's not working either after 1998. And so the things that make the diastolic pressure go up aren't occurring, and the ALJ, you know, one has to have confidence the ALJ took the real facts about this real man into account in coming to the decision. So maybe you could address both of those.
The ALJ, in the context of looking at Dr. Suresh's conclusion about the frequency of disabling symptoms, noted two instances in which his diastolic pressure was over 100 and said there were only two. Well, after an exhaustive look at the record, we know that's wrong. I've been able to identify five. And those were
we found six, but anyway, I mean, there's a number that's
there's a
number,
yeah.
That's the number that the ALJ found, let's say.
I believe the ALJ's discussion of the rest of the evidence, he has another paragraph shortly after that paragraph where he gives a summary of the plaintiff's treatment history and notes, you know, the effect of medicines and the effect of working or not working and the blood pressure remaining generally under control, his cardiac condition remaining generally stable, not having cardiac ramifications from the history of hypertension. That discussion by the ALJ is a fair and representative sample of the record in this case. There are also six occasions on which Mr. Bartholomew's doctors went out of their way to note in the treatment records that his blood pressure was in control or excellent. Those are equal. There are many other instances in which his diastolic pressure was in the 72 to 88 range, generally normal. The doctors didn't go out of their way to comment that it was in control, but it was recorded in a normal range. And those are in addition to the six instances in which they found it to be in control. The ALJ's conclusion, therefore, that the frequency of symptoms was less than asserted by Dr. Suresh and less than asserted by plaintiffs in his disability claim is supported by the record as a whole.
Were there lots of instances of this, of taking blood pressure? I mean, when you say there are five or six, where it was 100 or more, out of how many tests?
I can't tell you the number. I haven't counted them up, Your Honor. But the,
lots?
Lots. The man saw his physician faithfully. He saw his he primarily saw a nurse practitioner, Ms. DeCiro, and she was his treating source. Dr. Suresh, I have not seen any evidence in the record that he examined or treated plaintiffs. He was a physician at the clinic at which Ms. DeCiro practiced.
Was she a nurse practitioner or something?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was she the one taking the blood pressure? And
yes, she was the one who saw him on a regular basis.
Did he take his own blood pressure?
Pardon?
Did he do his own blood pressure test at home?
There are a few notes in Ms. DeCiro's notes where she said, where he reported his blood pressure at home was X, and she recorded it also herself that day. We're only relying on the ones that a doctor or a nurse has recorded.
Because apparently it's significant whether or not you take your medicine, or perhaps when, I don't know.
Yeah, there's only one instance in this record of Mr. Barthelemy not being recorded as not having taken his medicine.
So we assume then that he's been taking it.
We assume he's taking his We assume he's been taking his medicine generally. The ALJ didn't use noncompliance as a reason to discount it. He used the sheer fact that it was generally controlled with the medicine.
But what about the stress point?
The stress point, Mr. Barthelemy's job was particularly stressful. The ALJ found he could no longer do that job, both primarily because it was medium in exertion, which the doctors have all said he cannot do, he can do light exertion. Mr. Barthelemy, there's no record in the evidence of having done any job that was less stressful than that one, which also caused it to go up. Dr. Crawford.
But when you say it's a stressful job, please, I mean, the manager of one of these little gas station convenience stores, if that for him is stressful, it's hard to imagine what wouldn't be.
The commissioner's has a ruling on mental limitations and non-exertional work, and it talks about the triggers for stress are not the same for any two people. Some things can be tremendously stressful for some people that are, you know, provoke no stress in other people. It's probably not appropriate for us to, make assumptions about what would or wouldn't be. What we know is that...
But we have to know that the question that was posed to the vocational expert incorporates this person's response to stress, because if he feels, that just sitting there, that the classic taking tickets at a movie theater kind of non-exertional job, if that's stressful to him, maybe his blood pressure will shoot through the ceiling, and suddenly there he is fainting on the floor.
What we have, the evidence we have in this case, is that at the hearing at which Dr. Crawford testified, which would have been the third hearing, I think, she noted that anxiety seemed to be a problem with controlling his blood pressure, and that should be investigated. The ALJ sent, after that, they sent the plaintiff for a psychological evaluation to explore that aspect. The psychologist, having looked at all the records, knowing that he had high blood pressure and obesity and that his blood pressure had been difficult to control, looked at those records, examined him, came to the conclusion that he had to have some limitations, that he had an adjustment disorder. The psychologist did not find an anxiety disorder. The psychologist did not find particular limitations on mental activities. The ALJ presented the description of the claimant from that psychological evaluation to a VE, a vocational expert at the hearing, and the VE said that description would be consistent with the person who can perform the demands of unskilled light work. I'll briefly touch on the issue of the fairness of the hearing. In this case, the ALJ seems to have proceeded in an unusual way, but the commissioner doesn't believe that in any way raises prejudice or a problem with the hearing. The ALJ noted that he had never used Dr. Crawford as a medical expert before, and he spent a greater than normal amount of time discussing the history of the case. The ALJ then said, proceed to tell us, Dr. Crawford, your summary of this case. Dr. Crawford was allowed to testify in a narrative fashion at her own will and without interruption about her impression of the case and the medical records. After she was finished, the ALJ asked follow-up questions. Some of those were in the sort of form of questions where isn't it correct that, clarifying his assumptions. And sometimes when the ALJ said, isn't it correct that, Dr. Crawford said, yes, Your Honor. Sometimes she said no. She was not intimidated to agreeing with everything the ALJ said. She was allowed to testify in a narrative format to give her impressions of the case, and we don't believe that anything that happened at this hearing is cause to find the ALJ was biased. Thank you.
Your time's also expired. I'll give you 30 seconds if you really have something to add. We know he's in Detroit, so we don't have to worry about him anymore.
Brief is the name of the game. That's how they put this on the title. I think that the whole issue about the exertional thing is rather moot since we're dealing with a totally non-exertional impairment. The testimony of the IME concerning being able to do light activities is not relevant because it's a non-exertional impairment. My guy could probably do heavy work as far as lifting. I don't think that's an issue. The issue is, can he work with the blood pressure? So I think we're talking about apples and oranges. He did see a physician safely. And the whole situation here is does the record support the regulation where it says the treating physician's opinion has to be accepted if it's supported by substantial evidence? And the fact is, it is.
Okay. That's good.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Case will be taken under advisement.